Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll visit with the radiant mezzo-soprano Karine DeA to talk about her leading role in San Francisco Opera's production of Cinderella. From across Grove Street at Davies Symphony Hall, we'll learn more about the San Francisco Symphony's upcoming tour through a studio visit with Samuel Adams, who returns to KLW to share more about his work Drift and Providence, which is included on the symphony's upcoming tour and is being performed here this week. Stephanie Weissman, artistic and executive director of The Marsh since its inception, talks about The Marsh at 25 and this Saturday's special upcoming gala to celebrate the occasion. And critic reviewer Peter Robinson shares his thoughts on the Edward Snowden documentary, Citizen Four, and offers us some theatrical diversions. Stay with us. On Sunday, the San Francisco Opera presents the first of six performances of Rossini's La Cenerentola, or Cinderella, in a Jean-Pierre Ponel production conducted by Jesus Lopez Cobos. In the title role is mezzo-soprano Karine DeA, who makes her San Francisco Opera debut in this role and joins me in studio today. She's a former company member of the Opera Nacional de Lyon and has also graced the operatic stages of Madrid's Teatro Real, the Paris Opera, and is at the Salzburg Festival as well, as among many others. She also recently made her debut at the Metropolitan Opera in the role of Cybele in Faust. Karine, welcome to KLW.
Thank you.
And welcome to San Francisco. I understand this is your first visit.
Yes, my first visit, and I'm really happy to do my debut.
How exciting. Now, in its day, this opera, written in 1817, the popularity of it rivaled that of Rossini's Barber of Seville, but it kind of fell out of the repertoire, largely due to the demands that the composer placed on this title role, a coloratura contralto. Now, it wasn't until the 1960s that the work finally regained a foothold in the repertoire, with a new generation of mezzo-sopranos and contraltos being trained. Now, how does this role lie for you in your voice?
La Cenerentola. I like this role, really. I like. I think Rossini wrote really good for the mezzo-soprano voice, because he used the all... voice, high and low notes, and I like this role because it's really happy for the moment, and another moment it's really sentimental. You can show so many colors, so many sentiments. It's really I can do. It's like, for the voice, a gift. It's like a gift for the voice.
Yeah, sure. Well, like so many of Rossini's operas, there's so much vocal gymnastics that are involved in this role. I'm wondering, do you warm up differently for a Rossini opera than you do for some other composer?
Yes, it's true. It's true. Because for Rossini, we have to sing really, really fast. Really fast, and even to pronounce the text, it's really fast too. And finally, when we sing, it's the different singing, even for the breath, because to sing really fast for Rossini, you have to sing lighter for the voice. It's the sensation, and especially to warm up the highest note, but lowest note too, because I think Rossini and Bellini too used all notes of the voice, and for every waltz, it's like that.
Now, you've done this role at the Opera Nationale de Bordeaux, at Opera d'Avignon, where you'll return in January in recital, and also at the Paris Opera in the same Ponel production. Is this now a favorite role for you?
It was my favorite role, but now I think it's Romeo from Capuleti, Montechi, Bellini, but it's similar Whiten. It's really because it's bel canto. It's a wonderful Whiten for singers Bellini and Rossini. But it's a great pleasure to sing another time this fall.
Is there someone either from the remote past or recent past that you turn to as inspiration for this role?
Yes, we have to find something by herself. But finally, the director, staging director, is present to show something, and it's different when we have different characters too. It's like a troupe. It's a team, and especially for Rossini, it's really important. We are a team on stage.
This is an adaptation of the Cinderella story. Now, I always thought that the Cinderella story was one of the Brothers Grimm stories, but it turns out it has much older roots.
But you know, it's adaptation because before you can't show the foot on stage. It's impossible to show a foot of a woman. Yes, and it's for that is different, and it's better to show the arm. It was for that. Rossini changed the story about that. Yes.
Was it just for propriety?
Yes.
Oh, I had no idea.
We can show the foot and the leg of the woman on stage, you can imagine. Only the dancer.
What Karine is referring to is that instead of a glass slipper, now it's a bracelet that identifies Cinderella.
Yes,
I should mention that it has French origins. Cendrillon by Charles Perrault, who lived from 1628 to 1703, is the original author of the story, who actually laid the foundations for what became known as the fairy tale, also giving us Little Red Riding Hood, Puss in Boots, and Sleeping Beauty, as well as the original tales of Mother Goose. Many of those were then adapted by the Brothers Grimm.
Yes.
We should mention some of those differences in this operatic adaptation. We mentioned that instead of a slipper, there's a bracelet that identifies the princess to be. Also, the evil stepmother is replaced by evil stepfather, Don Magnifico.
It's true.
And instead of a fairy godmother, we have a philosopher.
It's true.
who is the prince's tutor. So
yes.
It's a little bit of a different story. Not expecting the Disneyfied version.
Yes. And finally, there are so many men characters on stage. I think it's to show the difference between female roles and masculine roles, to show the girls and finally to show the Cinderella the most high, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned that this is the same Ponelle production that was done at the Paris Opera. Have you worked with any other members of this particular team before? Have you worked with Maestro Cavoche before or not?
No, but I worked before with René Barbera, my prince, because we did just before in Paris in Il Barbiere di Siviglia. And I worked before with Carlos Chausson, my father. We did the same production, Ponelle production in Paris 3 years ago.
Very nice, very nice. What can you tell us about this production?
We like. No, but it's strange because the production now is almost 50 years, you can imagine. And for me, it's really really young production. It's fairy, it's not old. I like this production, and I'm sure it will be continued again in the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned your upcoming recital at Opera d'Avignon. What is planned for that?
For the recital?
Yes.
I like to sing with piano, too. I'm sure we need to play on stage, but we need to sing leader and French melodies with piano because it's totally different, but it's really important. I said always, when you sing melody, it's really good to play a character on stage, and when you play a character on stage, it's really good to sing a melody with the piano, because with the piano we are not costume, And it's really important to show the emotion with the eyes, with the expression on face. And we need both, really.
Hmm. Is this the same recital program that you'll be repeating at the Kennedy Center in February?
No, different. I have different pianists. I have Philippe Cassar in Avignon and another pianist in Washington, but similar program because they asked me French melodies. And it's always around Fauré, Debussy, Gounod, Ravel, Duparc. My favorites.
Mm, very nice. I wish I could make it down to that. Well, after February, you're back to the Met in Les Contes d'Hoffmann, or The Tales of Hoffmann.
Yes, I'm really happy to come back. And with the role Niklaus and La Muse, because I did only one time in Toulouse, and I'm really happy to sing another time Niklaus and La Muse in Les Contes d'Hoffmann. And it will be my first time with Maestro James Levine. And, I'm really happy and exciting about that.
So the stages of the Met, Teatro Real in Spain, the opera stages of Paris. Any favorite house of yours at this point in your career?
It's difficult to say because I like different places. The Metropolitan, it's really big, and in the same time, the acoustic is really fantastic. I like the Liceo Barcelona too. San Francisco, it's new for me, but I like too. Finally, not my favorite, but Paris, it's like my home, because I did my first opera 12 years ago in Paris, and Il Barbiere last month, it was my 21st productions. You can imagine. Yes, I go once or twice by year, and it's like my home now.
Very nice, very nice. Other roles that you're preparing for or looking forward to?
The role?
Which roles down the calendar are you looking forward to performing?
I have so many. but new, not really new for the moment.
Okay.
Maybe I can say in Paris, the new role, I will sing in next September, my first Donna Elvira and Don Giovanni. And I'm really excited to change a role.
Is there a role that you are not quite ready for? I know that opera singers in various stages of their career either shouldn't or aren't ready for certain roles. Is there a role down in your future that you're looking forward to being ready for and ready to present?
For the moment, I don't read really the new roles, but we think, because when we are older, the voice change, and now I can sing the Massenet repertory or Bizet or Berlioz, but I'm really prudent about that, because I would like always sing for the moment Rossini and Baroque music and Mozart, and I go with till the other repertory, but really prudently.
Well, I wish you a wonderful role, Toi Toi Toi, for Cenerentola here in the city.
I take.
And I hope you find time to discover San Francisco while you're here.
Okay, thank you.
Now, I mentioned some of the vocal gymnastics that are involved in most Rossini operas. In particular, let's hear a bit of the virtuosic aria Non più mesto that tells us, tell us what's going on in this. It occurs fairly late in the opera. You've got to save up some chops for this.
Yes, but it's the end of the opera, and we are so happy to sing during 2 hours and a half. And we are supported by the others on stage, and it's a great moment. Mm. Great moment.
This is a moment of reconciliation as well.
Yes. Really.
Karine, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Here is Karine de A singing Non più mesta from her Paris production, also the Jean-Pierre Panel production aforementioned. You can hear her at the San Francisco Opera House this Sunday through the 26th. Information on all things Cenerentola and SF Opera at their website, sfopera.com. Angelina, the Cinderella character in Cenerentola, and that live recording. You can hear her at the San Francisco Opera with co-star Rene Barbera as the Prince this month. Visit sfopera.com for details. Still to come, a visit with composer Sam Adams to talk about his work Drift and Providence, which will be featured in the San Francisco Symphony's upcoming tour. Plus, Peter Robinson shares his take on the documentary Citizen Four. And next, well, a major player in the San Francisco theater scene, Stephanie Wiseman, co-founded and has been artistic executive director of The Marsh since its inception in 1989. Under her leadership, The Marsh has grown from a one-night-a-week performance series to producing some 600 to 700 shows annually on its four stages. In addition to its developing work performance series, The Marsh's programs include artists in residencies, after-school workshops for at-risk youth, and performance development classes and workshops. In 1996, Stephanie spearheaded the drive to successfully buy their 12,000-square-foot facility on Valencia Street in San Francisco. In 2010, The Marsh expanded to a second venue in Berkeley. Stephanie has degrees in psychology and English from SUNY Buffalo, State University of New York. Her journalism, prose, and poetry has been published nationally, and she was awarded a grant from the New York State Council on the Arts, among other works. More recently, her opera, Aphrodisia, was performed to critical acclaim. It is indeed a pleasure to welcome back to the KALW area, airwaves, this Bay Area treasure. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, David. Thank you.
Of course. Well, we have to start with the Marsh, or more accurately, the Marsh, a breeding ground for new performances, as the Marsh's full title is known. How and where did you get that title for this organization?
Well, I lived on Delaware Bay in Delaware on a marsh, and it was the most miraculous breeding ground in the world, or one of, and just...
For more than just artistic things, I imagine.
Yeah, no, it was the birds and the crabs and, you know, and watching all that, and... When I came back to California and decided to start a series, a one-night-a-week series, we're like, well, what to call it? What to call it? And I said, well, what about The Marsh? Which didn't really quite work on its own. So that's how it ended up, The Marsh, a breeding ground for new performance.
And it stuck.
It stuck.
And it's stuck for, been sticking now for some 25 years.
That's right.
Is The Marsh in 2014 very different from The Marsh of 25 years ago?
Yes and no. The same vision and mission, but 25 years ago, it was just one night a week on the stages of Hotel Utah. So it was 4 15-minute performances, which is now the same thing we do on Monday Night March. So we still do the same thing we did 25 years ago, but we've evolved and expanded, going from one night a week to 7 to 10 shows to 600 to 700 a year in 2 different places.
That's amazing. And you got into Valencia Street at just the right time, purchasing that facility.
Well, yes, it was before the time. So it made it easy, a lot easier. We were actually on 3 spaces on Valencia Street and ended up there after we'd been thrown out of one and then moved into one I didn't think was very good and then moved into what was Bay Jones Jazz Club.
Hmm. Now it's the hot spot of the city. Congratulations for that. You must get some nice foot traffic.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I, oh, you know, we were an anchor of that because we brought all those people in to see Charlie Varen's Rush Limbaugh Night School. And people came down there and ate in the restaurants. And the whole area, you know, partially started to boom because we were there. It's kind of like the dogs, then the arts move into a neighborhood.
Right. And the food. Oh, my gosh. It's definitely the place to go now. You've been called an angel of the arts and the most unproducer-like producer someone has ever met. Now, how do you feel about those monikers?
Well, I probably, you know, I have no theater training. So maybe that's why I'm an angel. But mostly, I didn't know they call me the angel of the arts, but that's nice. Anyway, you just do what comes up. It's a very organic evolution of performances. And because we have so many different options for people, anywhere from volunteering to taking a class to doing the Monday Night Marsh, then we have a rising series where we basically audition full-length runs so we get to see it because I'm more interested in seeing the show and working with the person than reading a script or anything like that. And then if we like that, then we put it on for a run.
Hmm. Now, tell me a little bit about the mission statement of The Marsh. Is it, you know, mostly are featured solo performers. Is it that strictly the rule for it has to be a solo performance, monologue driven for a main stage performance?
There are no rules at The Marsh. The hope is they're technically and artistically really good things. But we don't really have room, for instance, to have an opera like the Opera House has.
Right, right.
Solo performance is a wonderful, intimate experience for people. And I love solo performance. I didn't always necessarily, you know, I felt in a small place where you're in relationship to things. So it's more about the intimacy and the quality of the work than, say, like maybe a more typical artistic director would say, we have a season, we want this kind of show, we want this kind of show, we want this kind of show. It's just more about what's growing up at The Marsh.
Mm, interesting. And who would you consider the most... the success story of The Marsh, to say, reflective of, hey, that person started here?
Well, there's a lot of them. So our first show we ever did was by Josh Kornbluth, and he did Haiku Tunnel. That was our first full-length show.
I'm going to have a little fun with you. There's a bell that we use for Minds Over Matter in the other show when someone has a right answer. For every person you mention at the Marsh that we've had on open air, at least during my tenure, I'm going to ring a bell.
All right.
So,
Margo Gomez, Brian Copeland, Dan Hoyle, Jeff Hoyle, Don Reed.
Don Reed. I don't see that one. All right.
You should have him on.
We should have him on, yeah.
You know, he was the warm-up comedian for Jay Leno for many, many years.
Wow.
Good person to have on, I bet.
I'm sure. My producer's chiming in that we tried to get him on, but...
He doesn't live here. He flies up every week from L.A. Can you imagine?
Wow. That's neat.
Yeah. Because he works during the day, like Jay Leno or whoever he's working with. And then I think he's on What's My Line now.
Hmm. And where do you see the Marsh 10 years from now, or even 25 years from now?
All I see is a vast waterland with a house.
And a dog. And a dog. Don't forget the dog.
Yeah, the dog. Yeah. The dog. I see us doing the same thing we're doing, but having more support for what we're doing. And I think, the Marsh has so much content. And the difference now between when we started is the whole issue of the digital age and digital media. And is there a way to appropriately integrate that into the Marsh? So the work that we do here stays here. It's local, but it goes global.
Right. All right. Every organization has a sort of wish list. What's on the top of the Marsh's wish list? What do you want to see happen at either of the venues that you really like to see move forward, move the organization forward?
The first thing that came to mind, which is a joke, swamp cooler. I would like to see us be able to, in some solar way, increase the amount of electricity we have in our building on Valencia Street, which is the one that we own, and be able to cool the place down, warm the place up, make it a more sustainable building and make it one where we can get more energy in. Because for us to get air conditioning in our space would mean like you have to go to a different phase, which is a tremendous amount of money. Mm. But why not do it in a solar fashion? And if anyone could let me know, Stephanie@themarsh.org, mm-hmm. if that is even possible or just some pipe dream, I would love to hear about it.
Well, I see a beautiful partnership with some sort of solar company that has a nice ad in your programs, and in exchange you get some solar panels up on top.
Exactly.
There you go. Stephanie@themarsh.org.
Correct.
Send those emails.
All right.
Well, let's go on to this big gala celebration this weekend. Who's coming?
Well, what's interesting about who's coming, we do so many shows that we have a lot of people coming. We have 25 performers coming.
Wow.
And they
range. Some of the aforementioned ones, I imagine?
Yes, yes. All of them.
Wow.
That we mentioned. Oh, except for Dan Hoyle, because he's in New York.
Ah.
But, what's interesting, right now on our stage, we have, Piper Ferreira. He's doing Cops and Robbers in Berkeley. And that's an amazing show about a hip-hop artist that turned to sheriff. He'll be there. Don Reed, who maybe, he'll come in tomorrow for your show. he's going to be there. He's doing... semi-famous Tales of Hollywood. Rebecca Fisher will be there. She's doing Memphis on My Mind. Ah! She's been here. We have Brian Copeland. He's doing a couple of things. He's doing a rep right now of Not a Genuine Black Man and The Waiting Period. And he'll be doing The Jewelry Box in December. Will Durst coming. Then we have Margo Gomez, who is just at the Marsh. Jeff Hoyle is coming with a 2015 show, Lear's Shadow. We have, who did I forget? Oh, my God, 25.
Charlie Varon.
Charlie Varon. Oh, my goodness. Did I not mention Charlie Varon? He's coming. He's actually even an artist in residence at the Marsh, along with David Ford, who will be there but not performing.
Oh, I see another name here, Joshua Brody.
Joshua Brody's coming. And the thing about Joshua Brody, who I think he's maybe the only performer that can say this, he has been in every single venue we've ever had.
Wow, that's great.
Which is six.
Oh, nice, nice. Marilyn Pittman, who also is one of our co-founders of Out in the Bay, did a solo show down there a while back.
And she'll be there.
Oh, there we go.
She'll be there. I bet you it's almost like the bell. There's everybody you say, they'll be there. So you should all should be there.
Right. Why not? Yeah. Information about that at themarsh.org. It's the 25th anniversary gala, Saturday, November 8th. At 6 o'clock, a VIP reception at 5:30. Mix and mingle with some of these great people. So what's the next show that people need to go see at the Marsh?
There's a couple of that are coming up. You mean like right now or coming?
By the way.
Well, you need to see all the shows that are there currently.
Okay.
And I think I already went through that.
Right.
And then upcoming is all these shows we're doing in 2015 as part of our anniversary. So like the Jeff Hoyle show. Don Reed's doing a new show. Charlie Varon's going to be doing Feisty Old Jew in Berkeley. He hasn't done it there yet. Josh Kornbluth is, you know, wonderfully developing because improvs right now of his piece about Zen hospice, which is unbelievably heartwarming. You know, it's end of life issues. It's kind of like what happened previously in end of life issues. And I think Josh uses the example of his father versus what can happen if you go to a place like Zen hospice. You know, it seems like a dark subject, but I have to say it's an amazing performance. And that's happening on Thursday nights in our Berkeley Cabaret. You know, we have a cabaret and a bar in Berkeley as well as two theaters.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. I haven't been to the Berkeley venue yet.
It's beautiful.
Stephanie Weissman, I wish you a fabulous 25th anniversary and another 25 on top of it. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Also, a wonderful article about Stephanie in today's SF Chronicle. You can see it in print or online at sfgate.com. Again, all things about the Marsh at themarsh.org. Lots of great performers attending the gala on Saturday. You should too. The San Francisco Symphony is about to embark on a 7-city U.S. tour, but before they take off to their first destination, Kansas City, I don't think Take Me Out to the Ball Game is on the program, but it might be a nice touch. They're offering send-off concerts this week that includes Gil Shaham performing Prokofiev's second violin concerto and Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe with full chorus, as well as local composers Sam Adams, Drift, and Providence. Sam was last here on Open Air to talk about the San Francisco Symphony premiere of Drift and Providence back in 2012 and joins me in studio today. Sam was born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area, son of composer John Adams and photographer Deborah O'Grady. He studied music at Stanford and Yale as a self-taught bassist, and his music draws from his experiences in a diverse array of fields, including noise and electronic music, as well as jazz and field recording. He's received commissions from, among others, Carnegie Hall, the San Francisco Symphony, the New World Symphony, and St. Louis String Quartet. A violin concerto written for Anthony Marwood received its premiere with the Berkeley Symphony last February. Drift in Providence will be included on the symphony's national tour in 5 of the 9 tour performances this month, a work which was co-commissioned by the San Francisco Symphony and New World Symphony. Such a pleasure to welcome him back to our studios to talk about that and other projects. Welcome back, Sam.
Thanks for having me, David.
Sure. Now, you wrote that Drift in Providence is about the ocean with some very apparent Bay Area roots. What inspired the work?
I obviously grew up next to the bay. I grew up in Berkeley, and it's always been an incredibly important thing. I think not for me, but also for Californians in general, the idea of water. And I think musically, water translates in really compelling ways. So I thought I could create a piece about wetness and dryness. And at the time, I was also reading the works of Wallace Stegner and books like Beyond the 100th Meridian and thinking about the West and how it's defined by water, really. So that was kind of one poetic idea about the piece. And I think San Franciscans particularly respond to the piece because it's in many portions kind of enshrouded in this sonic mist or fog.
We certainly have that connection too with movements entitled Embarcadero and Divisadero.
Exactly. That's right.
But you also wrote that your idea is not to paint an impressionistic image like Debussy's La Mer, but rather, and I'm quoting here, the piece aims to develop a reactive sonic environment suggestive of a more contemporary disposition, that the water from whence we came is an object of psychological remove in a highly digitized and distracted life.
Yeah, well,
that's quite a sentence.
It's, I know, it's a big sentence. But yeah, I mean, I think this is the piece is not trying to paint kind of a romantic image of the sea. I think it's trying to describe, I don't want to say others, but maybe my own disposition, which is that I spend most of my life stuck to a computer, and I spend most of my life interfaced in a world of technology and busyness and noise. Yet at the same time, there's strikingly disconcerting things that are happening to our environment, with global warming and, of course, with the drought right now, so it seems particularly apropos. Mm.
How are you creating some of these sound environments? What sort of instruments are you combining together?
Well, a large part of the sonic component of the piece is how I handle the percussion. Their role primarily is to create a kind of acoustic white noise by scraping metallic instruments, instruments like umglocken and brake drums, sizzle cymbals. And through this, or I should say, from this kind of really hazy texture, I'm selecting certain frequencies and certain harmonies and pulling them out and kind of very subtly adding reverberation and resonance to create sounds that kind of fade in and out, much like the sounds that we hear in kind of modern industrialized life.
kind of
non-orchestral sounds.
Interesting. Aside from the Debussy Lamer comparison that you've mentioned, critic Joshua Cosman was very complimentary towards the premiere back in 2002 and likened it more to a Mark Rothko painting in sound. Now, I guess that could be good or bad depending on how you feel about Mark Rothko, I guess, right?
Well, I think that he was referring to particularly the beginning of the piece, how it's kind of structured and that there are these kind of large blocks of sounds, but they're not rectilinear, and the beginnings and ends of them are not clear. I think that kind of translates to maybe some of Rothko's images, you know, in that they're these big rectangles, but their edges are always kind of blurred in a really compelling way. So I think that's maybe what he was talking about.
Interesting, yeah. Now, will you be accompanying the symphony on any part of this tour?
Yes, I'll be there the whole time. We're going to, let's see, well, we start here, then we go to Kansas City, Ann Arbor, Michigan, where the piece will not be done. And then we'll be in,
Cleveland and Boston.
Cleveland, Boston, New York, and then Miami.
And then, yeah, we're ending up where Drift in Providence was born,
yeah,
Miami.
That's right. Not at the New World Center, where the premiere happened, but at the Arsch Center, which is actually in Miami proper, not on South Beach.
Has the piece changed much since Michael Tilson Thomas premiered it in 2002, first with the New World Symphony, then with the San Francisco Symphony?
Not much. There are some kind of subtle orchestrational differences. I added triple winds. The piece was originally four double winds, so, you know, two clarinets, two flutes, two bassoons, etc. And Michael also decided to expand the string section. So originally, I think we only had four bass players, and I think he uses the full section.
Well, heck, they're on the payroll.
Yeah, exactly.
Might as well get our dollars out of that.
And there, you know, of course, there are really small structural changes. You know, some nips and tucks. You know, seconds here and there. But it's amazing how just a really small curtailing of a section can have a really kind of large impact on the flow and pacing of a work.
Plus, it's been in your ears now for a couple of years, and that full orchestral verbis, or not just on your computer, so you have a different perception of how it comes across.
Exactly. Actually, I'm about to go to rehearsal, and I'm really curious to hear what it's, I mean, you know, to see how I respond to it emotionally, because it's more than 3 years old now, and I'm still young, so that's a sizable chunk of my life. And I've done so many, you know, 180-degree musical paradigm shifts since I wrote this piece.
So. Right. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. You were born in a very musical environment, your dad being John Adams. Now, how much of an influence does he have on your own style of writing?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I love his music, and I grew up with it, you know, being 6 years old and going to his concerts and not really understanding what was going on, but, you know, somehow, you know, allowing it to enter my psyche. But I think that I think what really connects us is less in our styles and maybe more kind of in what we value in music. But yeah, I would be lying if I said that he, you know, his music has not influenced me.
Well, let's hear a little bit of your music, something that you're going to be bringing back here next spring with the full San Francisco Symphony, a work called Radial Play that had its premiere with the National Youth Orchestra. So next May, we'll be able to hear this work with the San Francisco Symphony and then more with Sam Adams. Here's a touch of Radial Play, music of Samuel Adams. Of Radial Play as performed by the National Youth Orchestra and heard nationally on From the Top, the radio show. David LaTulipe here with Samuel Carl Adams. That work, Radial Play, will be heard next May with the San Francisco Symphony. Sam, you're also going to be back next April working on a couple of evenings as part of their new Soundbox series in a brand new space.
That's correct.
So what's being planned for that?
Well, the Zellerbach A rehearsal space at Davies Hall is currently under transformation, and the symphony is planning on presenting a new concert series, and the purpose is to bring in new works, multimedia artists, and present kind of new formats of concerts. The concerts will start at 9 and go until 11, and I think they'll be a little bit more casual. And it's really exciting. I can't wait to get started on my project.
Nothing quite on paper yet, though.
Nothing quite on paper. Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts still working on it. But the idea for my program, which will be done twice, once on April 9th and then again on the 10th, will focus on works by young composers. Everything that we'll present will be a piece that was written in the last, I guess, no more than 6 or 7 years, by a very wide variety of of young artists, which I think will be really exciting.
Well, how exciting to be in that first season of all that.
It's great. Yeah, absolutely.
And I understand you're also working on something for Sarah Cahill.
Yeah, that's correct. She has a commissioning project right now, and the idea behind it is to work with, I think she's working with 7 or 8 composers who will be somehow writing piano works in response to Terry Riley. His 80th birthday is coming up, so it's a big celebratory project. And I'm almost done with my piece. It's called Shade Study, and it's for piano and sine waves. Sine waves being the kind of purest, simplest electronic tones. She'll be presenting this piece, I believe, first as part of the New Music Gathering, which will happen at the San Francisco Conservatory between January 16th and 19th, I think. And then she'll take the pieces on a national tour in the spring.
Nice.
Really exciting.
Let's have you both on for that when that gets closer to date. Now, being trained as you were in classical music, first in piano when you were growing up, and no stranger, I'm sure, to attending symphony concerts, probably since you were very young, do you find it a bit weird to see your name on a program with, say, Mahler's Fifth Symphony, or in this case, Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe this weekend?
Yes, I guess. but at the same time, it makes me happy that organizations are prioritizing new work. I would like to see, and maybe this is a little bit idealistic, more concerts focused on purely contemporary work and not sandwiching them, the contemporary works in between Mahler and whatever, Ravel. But that being said, I'm so grateful that the symphony is allowing me to be in bed with those guys.
Well, it's great. I mean, it's so wonderful to see you evolve as a wonderful composer and to see your name on these programs and to experience it in the concert hall like that. Sam, I wish you all the best. We're going to go out with a little bit of Drift in Providence, which, again, you can hear this week with the San Francisco Symphony. Or if you happen to be touring the country yourself, check out the sfsymphony.org website to check out where the symphony will be. Maybe stop in and say hello. Here's music of Samuel Carl Adams, Drift in Providence. Samuel Adams' Drift and Providence, excerpt thereof, playing, I think it's this afternoon, just after open air today, at the San Francisco Symphony's Davies Hall. No, it's 8 o'clock this evening, Friday at 8, and then Sunday at 2 p.m., prior to the symphony's national tour, which will take them all across the country, and with Sam Adams in tow to hear some of his Drift in Providence being performed as part of the symphony's tour. Visit sfsymphony.org. for more information.
Listen, do you want to know a secret? stories not to tell. Whoa, whoa, closer.
That particular Beatles tune figures prominently in Critic at Large Peter Robinson's segment this week, doesn't it, Peter?
Yeah, hi, David, and it's good to be here. And yes, listen, do you want to know a secret? And indeed, you promised not to tell. Immortal words from an old Beatles tune, but today it applies to Edward Snowden. And I'm reviewing a new documentary. It's called Citizen 4. It's playing at the Raphael in Marin. And Citizen 4, in case you're looking it up, is all one word. It's a highly dramatic documentary, which I think really is viewing for everybody, whether you treat Snowden as a whistleblower or as a traitor or just as a well-informed and well-intentioned citizen. And it's a story which has been told already now in book form. The filmmaker, Laura Poitras, flew to Hong Kong after a lot of secret coding to conduct an interview. And the first interview is very much in a motel room in Hong Kong. And this was the first place after Hawaii when he left the National Security Agency that Snowden flew to. Now, a lot of it is print coming across the screen as though it's one journalist communicating with the other. But they had to encrypt very secretly, and they were very conscious, as the Beatles would put it, that somebody might be listening or somebody might be viewing. So I think socially, from a historian's point of view, this is an important piece of filmmaking. From a documentary point of view, it's a bit slow. Because there's not action, it's not a John le Carré novel where there's car chases and revelations, but there is that sense of escape. And as the story progresses, the journalist Glenn Greenwald, who is also in league with Snowden to put the story out there, goes through the various rigours of being searched at different airports, and you get that sense of how we came to know that we, as citizens in this country, are being watched. But, of course, it's not only us. The network extended to Germany, and one of the people who was most highly offended was Angela Merkel. So we have scenes from the UN, we have scenes from the European Congress as they're talking to each other and discussing what to do. Now, the three newspapers involved, the Washington Post in this country, the Guardian in the UK, and in Germany, Der Spiegel, are also involved in these revelations. So we get cuts of the newsroom in each of these newspapers. And I think one of the most revealing, because it's a newsroom I know well, it's the Guardian in London, where British security come in, and they are now having to smash with hammers and drills the hard drives of the computers. So I think this is a film for every citizen, and I think it doesn't matter on your political allegiance. It's one of those things that I think we all need to know. And also, take a warning next time you're on the net, next time you're on the phone, next time you're thinking you're on a website which is clear, informative and clean, there may be somebody out there, and they'll want to know, do you know what their secrets are?
The film is Citizen 4. You can catch it also at the Embarcadero here in San Francisco or out in Albany at the Albany Twin and at the Smith Rafael Film Center in San Rafael. Peter, I'd be remiss if I didn't point listeners also to our own website, KALW.org, where if you searched for Citizen 4 or Edward Snowden, you'd be able to call up Rose Aguilar's recent conversation with the filmmakers of Citizen 4. So as a good preparation, maybe you'll tune into a podcast or a recorded archive of that conversation of your call. Go to KLW.org.
Yeah, and it's just well to be well informed. I think that's what KLW, also programs like Frontline, do, and this is certainly in that category, the movie Citizen 4. So I've also been to a different type of cinematography. It's the National Theatre Live, and the play that I saw is called Skylight. It stars Bill Nighy. It's a three-hander, and he appears with Carey Mulligan. Now, let me say a little bit about the cinematography here, because, again, there's two theatres, one at the Kabuki and the other in Marin at the Lark Theatre, which carry these. And here the camera is on stage, around the stage, and it focuses on the actors. So in some sense, you feel you're actually in the theatre. It's not a movie, it's a movie of a play. And the way they do it is they'll look for gestures. So you actually see hand movements. The Bill Nighy story, Skylight, was actually written in 1993. It's by the playwright David Herr. And in the intermission, he does an interview with Anna Freud. So this is a good way of seeing something different to a film, not quite the same as a play, but you get that sense of intimacy as the actors talk and speak to each other. It's a love story with a twist. It's set in a small suburb of London. And as the story unfolds, restaurateur Bill Nighy gradually reveals his relationship with what was previously a house-sitting nanny. Then she became a waitress, and then something else. Highly recommended, the movie Skylight. And the second one, this time also playing at the Kabuki, is called Of Mice and Men. It's the famous story, and it's come from Broadway. And again, they're using a similar technique where the camera is just all over the place. So you get that real sense that you're sitting in the theatre. And I sometimes think if you make the comparison to sports or a baseball game, sometimes you get a better view on the television set than you do if you're up in the high boxes trying to squint through a pair of binoculars. And I think that's the comparison to the sort of cinematography they're using. Most of these come from the National Theatre in London, which, of course, is one of the mainstays of the London stage. And it's certainly one of the places where you will see great productions, well-produced, and a sense of the sets. Now, if you want to find out more about this, they have their own website. It's www, and then you have to put in lower caps, ntlive.com. And that will give you the various plays which are playing, because these plays do not stay long. They may come once or twice with a 1 or 2 week interval, but they are well worth going to. And two of the screens which are set up to carry this type of cinematography in the city here, the Kabuki, and in Marin County, the Lark Theatre.
Peter, thanks very much for that. We look forward to your next visit.
Good. Good to be here, David. Thank you.
Well, if you're not off to the theater or a theater to watch the theater or perhaps catching Citizen Four, there's all kinds of other great music happening. As I mentioned, the San Francisco Opera is well underway with Cenerentola. I believe Tosca is happening Saturday night, the San Francisco Symphony. And also the San Francisco Wind Ensemble is back in action for a concert Saturday night at 7:30, Aragon High School in San Mateo. Information at sfwindensemble.org. Martin Sigelka conducts. Soprano soloist Esther Rayo will join the wind ensemble in a performance of Alle Seelen by Richard Strauss. Also on the program, Vincent Persichetti's Psalm, Opus 53, and the U.S. premiere of Ferrer Farran's Symphony No. 4, El Coloso. San Francisco Wind Ensemble information, sfwindensemble.org. Also, the Oakland East Bay Symphony, under the direction of Michael Morgan, celebrating 25 years themselves, has their concert Friday evening at the Paramount Theater at 8 in Oakland. On the program, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony and a very special work, Chris Brubeck and Guillaume Saint-James' works, Brothers in Arts, 70 Years of Liberty, the West Coast premiere of this work. It's a new work for jazz quintet and orchestra. Chris Brubeck is the composer, also plays trombone. Guillaume Saint-James is a co-composer and playing on saxophones. Jerome Seguin on bass, as well as McKenna Liddell Wright and Nelly Ake as some vocal soloists. That's at the Paramount Theater Friday night at 7. Information at oebs.org. Speaking of saxophone, not necessarily Mr. Guillaume Saint-James, it is Adolph Sax's birthday. If you were listening to Morning Edition, you heard a great segment with with Miles Hoffman on the birthday of Adolph Sax, an interestingly large collection of saxophones in South Dakota, of all places. Adolph Sax, born on this date in 1814. In the background, a little bit of saxophone music, the Berlin Saxophone Quartet performing for you, a little Duke Ellington, as we round out this edition of Open Air. My thanks to Niels Swinkels, my producer of Open Air. A reminder that if you've got a performing arts group you'd like featured on Open Air, to send me an email, david@kalw.org. You can also go to our website, kalw.org. Open Airs are all archived at that website. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week.